I have a very simple subject today. The greatness of God. That is something that is absolutely impossible to describe for mankind. I have probably worn out that scripture so many times, maybe you get sick of it, but 1 Corinthians 2 and verse 9, I believe, is the verse where God has said, "Eye has not seen, nor ear heard, nor has it entered into the heart of man the things that God has prepared for him." So how am I ever going to talk to you about the greatness of God? Well, I can't get very real specific about all of that in terms of how he did it and what he did and so forth, but he gives us a lot of clues. Can't we talk about that? I want to talk about the greatness of God in a sense of looking at it. I believe we can. We can at least consider the things that he has revealed to us. In John, the first chapter, and we've covered this so many times you probably have it all by memory, John 1 and verses 1 to 3, you see, this is the very beginning, actually. In the beginning, in beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. And the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through Him. The word made. I'm not going to give you the Greek word. I probably couldn't pronounce it correctly anyway. But the word simply means it literally came into being. It was made. It literally came into being. That sort of clarifies it as far as the creation is concerned. It literally came into being through Him, and without Him, nothing literally came into being or came into being that was that already here, that is here, that was made. In Him was life, and life was the light of men. Now, if He created everything, how long did it take Him? How much power did it take to do that? Let's go to Exodus, the 20th chapter, to the scripture I hope we all know so well, to the verse we all know so well also, verses 8 through 11. You don't have to even turn to that, I guess. You all know it, I hope, by memory. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath to the Lord your God. In it you shall not do any work. You nor your son, nor your daughter, or your manservant, nor your maidservant, nor your cattle, nor the sojourner that's within your gates. For in 6 days, verse 11, how long did it take him? In 6 days the Eternal made the heavens and the earth, the sea, and all that is in them, and rested the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it. It was also a part of the creation of that creation week that we speak about. And he did what in 6 days? Created the heavens and the earth and all that is in them. What kind of power did that take? Think about that. Think about the absolutely unthinkable amount of power that it took. I told you before, I believe, that I had the privilege of counseling a man that was just writing his doctorate thesis at the University of California years ago. And he was studying, he wrote his thesis in theoretical physics. He was taking theoretical physics, and he was writing his thesis in the components of the atom, down inside the nucleus of the atom. And he was going into what they call these various items and so forth, and telling me some of the things about how much power relatively speaking, it takes to pull the little particles apart down in the inside of an atom. He's talking about electron volts, of course, and how many it takes to take those little pieces apart down in there. And I said, wait a minute. When I went to college back in the late 40s, why, all we knew about was electrons and protons and neutrons, and that's all. You see, as far as atoms were concerned, we didn't know all of this stuff, how to take them apart and all of that. But we have nuclear power now, and we have atomic bombs. You realize what that power is? I surely didn't. And on a relative circumstance, a relative condition, brethren, that's so far out of man's mind, it's just absolutely unbelievable. Now, I say that because I believe it, though. It says it. He did it. I believe it. I don't know how he did it, and I can't describe that to you, but that power was that absolutely unthinkable amount of power was there. I want to go to Genesis, the first chapter, and he gives us a description of the creation. You see, and I'm not going to stop and expound the first couple of verses. We've talked about that so many times, but in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth became without form and void. That is the same word that is used when Lot's wife became a pillar of salt. It wasn't that she was a pillar of salt. She looked back and she became a pillar of salt. Without form and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the earth. God was planning to change everything here on the face of this earth in a circumstance appropriate for man and for the development of his family. I think we all know and understand. That's all I want to say about that at this time. But verse 3 says, then God said, let there be light. Nothing happened, huh? No, that isn't quite what it says. He spoke and it was so. And there was light. It was darkness before, obviously. I mean, why would he say, let there be light if it wasn't necessary? Let there be light because it was dark before that. And God saw the light, that it was good, and God divided the light from the darkness. There's still an awful lot of darkness if you go out to space. You all know that. He divided the light from the darkness, and I can't describe all of that, how he did those things. Brethren, I believe it. I believe it, because he says he did. This is what he inspired Moses to write. And God saw the light, that it was good, and divided the light from the darkness, and God said, God called the light day, verse 5 says, and the darkness he called night. So the evening and the morning were the first day, and he did it all in one day? What kind of power does it take to do that? I want to focus on that somewhat. I want you to minds focused on that for a reason that I'll get to later. But verse 5, we go down to that part. Let's see. Verse 6 is where I want to pick it up now. Then God said, let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters, in the midst of the waters, and let it divide the waters from the waters. Now, water comes in different forms. We all know that. Water can be steam, vapor, and water is liquid that we know. And it can get pretty hard even if it turns into ice. We all are aware of that. So it can come in different forms. And the awesome, fantastic part about it is that most of the elements that God created, if they solidify, if those elements solidify, they get heavier. I don't think your mind can even comprehend what would happen if that happened to ice. and it all sank to the bottom, everything else would freeze up as it went down, you know, and everything would be gone. But God made those elements. I don't think we have the capability to even think about the awesomeness of how He created many of these things. This word firmament is also expanse in my Bible, as I have a margin reference to it. It would be a good translation for the word firmament. Now, I do read some of the commentaries, and I don't necessarily believe everything that's there, but we can think about this thing. And I said water comes in different forms. God didn't create the atmosphere and the circumstance as we have it anymore today, because Adam and Eve were in the Garden of Eden, and they were naked, and they weren't freezing to death out there in the chill of the night, and they didn't have sunburn from the hot burning sun boiling down on them, or didn't have to dodge hailstorms and tornadoes and all of that kind of stuff. See, the circumstance was altogether different, beautifully conducive to man living there in the natural state, naked, if you please. And they weren't ashamed, but they weren't freezing either. And that was a whole, that firmament was apparently a shroud around the earth that was a protective type of thing that was protective from the water vapor that was above the earth. And the water below, of course, is water. We know that. Oceans. And so God called the firmament heaven, verse 8 says, and the evening and the morning were the second day. All in one day He did that. Dividing of that, setting it up in that way. Verse 9. And God said, let the waters under the heavens be gathered together into one place. So we have oceans. Brought them into one place. And how? I don't know. He doesn't give me a description of how deep the ocean was or where it was located and how, all of that. And let the dry land appear. Now, what kind of power would it take to reach down there in the ocean and say, whoop, up comes a continent? The power of God. All in one day? Think about it, brethren. God called, the verse 10 says, He called the dry land earth, and He gathered together the waters He called seas. And God saw that it was good, and God said, let the earth bring forth grass and herbs. Now, it wasn't just a dead planet. He suddenly had plants all over it, the land. bring forth grass, the herbs that yield seed, and the fruit trees that yield fruit according to their kind. Had that all designed out. They don't cross kinds. Kind of throws the evolution right into the ocean. Excuse me, but it's crazy. Each one has its kind, all designated how God actually created it. Whose seed is in itself and on the earth, and it was so. Verse 12, and the earth brought forth grass, the herb that yields seed according to its kind, and the tree that yields fruit, whose seed is in itself according to its kind, though there are all various deviations in plants and the flora of the earth. And God saw that it was good, and the evening and the morning were the third day. All that happened in one day? It took a little power to do that, I'd say. Think of that. And God said, verse 14, let there be lights in the firmament of the heavens and divide the day from the night. Now, He had grass and trees and plants and everything on the face of the earth. It had to have sunshine. And I know there are all kinds of crazy theories that go on in religious circles about the earth that couldn't be done in a day, so God made, he used the thousand-year days to do this. Absolutely impossible. That grass is not going to sit there for 1,000 years waiting for the sun to shine on it. It just won't work. It might last overnight so that the sun could shine on it the next day. That makes sense. But God created the lights in the firmament of the heavens and divided the day from the night and let them be for signs and seasons. And you know the earth is tilted, and so we have... my daughter just came back from from Australia and New Zealand. Her daughter went to some programs down there that I don't know, her organization or schools put on, and my daughter went with my granddaughter down to that function. And so it's winter down there. And she just got back to describe some of that to me. But so they have seasons too. Let's see. For signs and seasons and for days and years, I didn't say that when God created the first day, what did that create? Time. There was no such thing as time prior to that. The rotation of the earth is 24 hours. It's a day. The first day was the first time there was time. God doesn't need time. He's been there forever. Time doesn't mean anything to God. And he's going to be there forever to come. But time is an element that he created here in the process of developing this whole system for mankind and getting it developed. Then he said it for seasons and days and years in verse 15, and let them be for lights in the firmament of the heaven to give light on the earth. And it was so. Give light on the earth. What is that light out there that gives light on the earth? Old Sol, you know, sun. Do you realize how much of that energy from that huge planet out there actually strikes that little ball called the Earth down here that's 93 million miles away from that orb out there that's called the sun? What percentage of that radiation, of that light all over the place gets down to Earth, that light that's... I said, I can't explain these things to you. It's absolutely impossible. I think of them and it just makes my mind go boing. I can't think of the awesomeness of them. That's all I'm trying to describe to you. The power of God. So far out that we can't grasp it. At least I can't. I hope you can. I can't. But it was so. And... The verse 16 says that he made the two great lights and the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night, and he made the stars also. Now, how that means, again, I don't know. Did he create them at that stage? I don't know. I simply don't know. That's all. I have to leave it there. God set them in the firmament of the firmament of the heavens and gave light on the earth. And... to rule over the day and over the night, and to verse 18 says, and divide the light from the darkness, and God saw that it was good, and so evening and morning were the fourth day. Now, interesting, we have plants and grass all over the earth, but there was no animation yet. Just another day. And God said, verse 20, let the waters abound with abundance of living creatures, nephesh, and let birds fly above the earth across the face of the firmament of the heavens. So God created great sea creatures and every living thing that moves with which the waters abound. No quadrupeds yet, no animals yet that have been created, but all of the sea creatures, all the fish and et cetera, the sea creatures, plus all of the birds of the heavens, according to their kind, and every winged and according to its kind, and God saw that it was good. And God blessed them, saying, "Be fruitful and fill the waters of the sea, and let birds multiply on the earth." And the evening and the morning were the fifth day. All of that in one day. Now, each one of these successive days, it took a little power to put all of these things together. A little power? So much that my mind can't even scratch the surface. The awesomeness of the power. I started to describe this matter of the power that holds the little elements of an atom together. I asked this scientist when he talked to me about that. I said, "You're so far over my head, I'm not even with you. But I'd like to ask you one question. If it takes all that tremendous relative power to take those little particles to pieces, I says, who do you suppose ever put them together in the first place?" I wish you could have seen his face. He studied for years on how to tear all that apart, you see. But he never really thought about it when he was in the lab there. Now, he could only think about it if someone like me came along and had to tell him that God created it all. But he wasn't thinking about that. And all at once, suddenly that thought hit him. If it took that horrendous amount of power to tear it apart, then it took a lot of power to put all that together, which God did in the first place. That's what atoms are made out of. Now, I had the privilege of... Privilege? It was anything but a privilege, but of being in the Army out in Deming, New Mexico for about 20 months. And one time I went up in an airplane with a man just out on flying in course. They had training courses, you know, that they flew. And we flew over White Sands, New Mexico. And he told me, he said, "We really don't know what's going on down there." We sure didn't. I knew a man that worked with me in Bakersfield, California, that was a technician there when he was younger, back in the days that it was the development of the atomic bomb. And he said that he worked in a certain section, and the people that worked in another section right adjacent to that were... what shall I say? I can't think of the word. They had to commit themselves to the fact that they wouldn't even talk to one another about the things that were going on in these, even in individual sections. That's how hush-hush everything was when they were developing that atomic bomb. Now, how big was the element that actually... turned into energy that destroyed the whole city of Hiroshima? They said the active element of uranium was about the size of your fist. Now, it was encased in a huge bunch of lead in order for protection, but the active element was the little piece about the size of your fist. How much energy was in that little piece? Enough to blow up the whole city. And God created all of that. Mankind finally learned how to turn some of that material, matter, back into energy. And that little chunk of energy, of material, destroyed the whole city. There was a lot of power in there when it was turned loose. The scientists literally, and I read some material on that even back in those days, that whenever they turned loose, one of the things they were scared of when they were developing the atomic bomb was if they ever started that reaction, they were afraid it would tear up all the atoms. Did you hear me? All the atoms. It wouldn't be stoppable, you see. If they ever got started, they were feared that it would destroy all the atoms that, within the whole environment. That means everything clear out to open space. Everything! But it wasn't so. They finally developed a system where they knew they wouldn't blow up everything, and they kept it confined to the uranium unit that they had. But these are the things that was the energy that was involved there. The energy that was involved, it was absolutely unthinkable, almost, as far as our minds are concerned. Yet that's what was contained there. Where did all that energy come from? Who created it? God put that together with the power that He has. And it's absolutely awesome, brethren. Now, we're confined to Mother Earth by gravity, of course. We know that. But I'll get to a little more of about us a little later here. But all of this God created in this very time. Now, verse 24. God says, let the earth bring forth the living creature according to its kind. Cattle and creeping thing and beasts of the earth. Each according to its kind. And it was so. Each one according to its kind. God made the various kinds. You can't cross genetic kinds. You can't cross cats and dogs. It won't work. And you can't cross cows and horses. It won't work. Can't be. Each one according to its kind. And verse 25, God made the beast of the earth according to its kind, cattle, and God saw that it was good. Verse 26, now, we have talked about the creation of man so many times that I probably don't have to dwell on this at all. I just want to read it, though, because in this sixth day, what did God actually develop? What He was after all the way along, in a sense, is to create images out of physical matter that could possibly be changed into His own very children. He created matter, and it wasn't animated at first. He had to create the animals. And He gave them a type of life, of obviously. He created them individually, male and female. I don't see it could possibly be any other way. But man, when He created man, He did it a little bit differently. Now, verse 26, God said, let us make man in our image. Ah, none of the other animals were in God's image. I say animals because there may well have been bipeds. That is, people, the animals that walk on 2 feet, as the apes do, you know, so many of them. But I'm not talking about apes. But apparently there were also animated beings that were in the shape of you and me, as far as we are concerned, because scientists have found bones that indicate that, but they were animals for one very important reason. God didn't put into them the spirit of man, the spirit of man, I said. It was the spirit of an animal. And they had that. I won't go into the details of that either because I frankly don't know much about them, probably not as much as some of you may. But anyhow, you know that it was so. But He said, let us make man in our image according to our likeness. And let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and the birds, over the birds of the air and over the cattle and over the earth and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. And God created man. He brought him into being, literally. Now, He did it from the dust of the ground. We read that in chapter 2, but I won't go into that here. He created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him, male and female. All of this done in that 1/6 day. Male and female, he created them. And God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it, have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, over every living thing that moves in the waters. And everything would have been harmonious and lovely if they had done it as God told them to. Now, you know they didn't, of course, but that's not my purpose in this sermon. My purpose here is to look at the power that it took to do that, to make that. Think about it. And God said, see, I have given you every herb of that yields seed, which is on the face of the earth, and every tree with fruit yields seeds, and it shall be for food. I'm not going into the controversy about whether or not they had access to animal meat, food, that animal type of food or not. That makes no difference as far as I'm concerned, because I frankly don't know the answer to it anyway. And to every beast of the earth, verse 30 says, to every bird of the air and to everything that creeps on the earth in which there is life, I have given every green herb for food. And it was so. Then God saw everything that he had made, and he made man, the final one, the last one of his creation, on that 6th day. And that was really, shall I say, the epitome of it all, of his creation. And so the evening and the morning were the 6th day, but that wasn't the end of creation. There was another day yet in the week before it finished the entirety of the 7-day week that was created. Thus the heavens and the earth, verse 1 of chapter 2 says, the heavens and the earth and all the host of them were finished. And on the 7th day, God ended his work which he had made. He must have got tired, huh? All the work that he did, he surely would, you would think that he'd got tired. But you see, God doesn't have to rest, not like we do. He's spirit. But he did, he rested for a reason. Why? For mankind that wears out and gets tired and has to have rest. And so he created a day of rest for mankind. And thus the heavens and the earth were finished, verse 1 says, and the host of them were finished. And on the 7th day God ended his work which he had done, and he rested on the 7th day from all of his work which he had done. And God blessed the 7th day and sanctified it. If he sanctified it, it's set apart. Even as the commandment says, you know, the Exodus 20 and verse 11, I just read it back there, where he sanctified the 7th day and set it apart. And he rested from all the work which he had made and How much energy was expended? How much power did he expend in order to do all of that? Unthinkable amount of power. Now, I could go to all kinds of examples all over the Bible about fantastic miracles that he did that took unthinkable amount of power also. You could just cite the crossing of the Red Sea, for example. When several millions of people went maybe 5 to 6 miles, whatever that distance was at that particular place, across the Red Sea. Millions of people across there in one night. How long do you think it would have taken them if there were 4 abreast? Try a couple of million and take them across there, 4 abreast, and leave maybe 3 feet between the 4. You'd probably be a couple of years getting them all across there if there were that many. God opened up a passageway that's absolutely unthinkable. but nothing's impossible with God. And it was dry land they went across on. Now, the power of God was capable of doing that. He spoke and it was so. He did it. I don't know how. I told you I can't explain how he did it. But it tells me that he did, and I believe it. I believe it. I say that because we could turn to all kinds of miracles that he did. There are many ways in which we could talk about that. The Noachian flood was no little thing. Yet he did all of that by the awesome power, and the earth was covered with water clear over the earth, and I've thought about that many, many, many times. The actual earth, the water covered the earth, and so the earth had to be sort of back to where it was when he said there was water under the earth and water above the earth, but the water covered all of the mountains. Does that mean it was on the surface of the earth up higher than Mount Everest? Think about this. You can't live up there. It's impossible. You can't breathe that high. Wasn't that way. That wasn't the way it was. You see, God, when he dried up the earth, when the water reformed after so many days, he reached down and picked up those continents and right up out of the water. And so we have a Grand Canyon that didn't happen there by just a bunch of water trickling down a creek. I'll tell you that for sure. That would have been impossible. But when the water was brought up like that and it sliced off and it was all, of course, soaked wet, then it just washed out of Grand Canyon. I only cite that because we could go to all kinds of phenomena on the face of the earth that proves that God brought the mountains up out of it, just as it says over in Psalm 104. Maybe if I quote it, I better quote it. I don't have it in my notes, but Psalm 104, I believe it's verse 30 that I want. Verse 30 says, in Psalm 104 and verse 30, he says, you set forth your spirit. That's where the power came from now. You set forth your spirit. They are created. And you did what? You renew the face of the earth. He renewed it. He brought up the sea lands and the continents and all of this God did in the awesome power that he had in the process of creation. I said we could go to all kinds of examples, and I cited the Red Sea. But I want to go to the one most important of all. The Creator that had all of that awesome power that did the creating, the Word. Without Him was not anything created that was created. He had all of that absolutely awesome power, capability. And He gave that all up. I want you to think about that. He gave that all up. Divested Himself of that completely. Now, I'm not going to go through a whole bunch of scriptures here. I'm going to go over to Philippians, the second chapter, where it states that very clearly. Philippians chapter 2. Philippians chapter 2, and we've gone over that verse, or those passages many times also, as far as that part is concerned. But that Creator God, that great being that had all of that absolutely unthinkable power, gave that all up, divested himself of that power to humble himself in order to become a man. just like you are. Just like I am. Animated man, being. And almost unbelievable. Philippians 2 and verse 5. Let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus. That is going to be some undertaking. And for you to have that mind in you. Let that mind be in you that was in Christ Jesus, who being in the form of God, did not consider it bribery to be equal with God. I'm reading from the New King James here when I read that verse. That verse has always been a little hard for people to explain and understand. I have a copy of Nelson's Study Bible, the King James Version of the Study Bible. And I quoted their commentary right out of that book, and I have it written here, and I'm going to quote it for you verbatim, word for word, the way they stated it. I thought it was worth reading to you. I don't necessarily agree with everything that these commentators put in there, but I thought at least this explanation was worth our reading. This is from the New King James, that is from the King James Version of the Bible. And it's verses 6 to 8, and they said it could be translated as follows, quote, for he, though eternally possessing the divine nature, did not regard his existing in a manner equal with God as something to be selfishly maintained. I kind of like that. That is really what that verse is saying. He gave it up. Really. And I stopped there because there's a comma there. Something to be maintained. But he emptied himself in that he assumed a servant's nature and appeared in the likeness of men. And having been recognized in outward form as a man, he humbled himself in becoming obedient unto death, even the death of crucifixion by crucifixion, unquote. That's the way they said that those two verses could be translated. I kind of like that because it sort of clarifies the fact that here in Philippians 2, verse 6, he made himself, being in the form of God, did not consider it robbery to be equal with God. He was so unselfish that he didn't hold that as more important than the development of God's family. Think about it. Verse 7, he made himself of no reputation, taking the form of a bondservant. I'm reading now from the New King James. And coming in the likeness of men. And verse 8, and being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself. I think that's the understatement of the whole universe, to be frank about it. The Creator, with all of that awesome power, humbled himself to become like me. Unthinkable. And became obedient to the point of death, even the death of the cross. That's what he did. Now, why? There is no way that mankind could have life once Adam and Eve sinned, and all have sinned and come short of the glory of God. There's no way that we can have life except for that miracle. That awesome power, the capability to do that. That Creator did that for you and for me. We could never, never have opportunity to have life at all. Now, I am not unaware of the fact that if you read commentaries, man, they killed Christ because he claimed to be the Son of God. And if you say that you are to become children of God, ultimately, they'd find a way to kill you, too. That's about the way the world is. They say, well, you're making yourself God. No, no, you're not. God did it. Through that awesome power that he did. I want to talk about that just a little bit. 1 John, the 3rd chapter, and I don't need to turn to a lot of verses. That's the one that sort of clinches it all. 1 John 3. 1 John, the 3rd chapter. And I'll read verse 1 to 3. 1 John, the 3rd chapter, verse 1. Behold what manner of love the Father has bestowed on us, that we should be called children of God. Now, I won't go into the division of the Father and the Son here and all of that, but you know that Jesus said, nobody can ever come to me except the Father who has sent me call him. And then he says, I'll raise him up in the last day. And he says, I'll pray the Father and he'll give you another comforter, that is, the Holy Spirit to dwell in you, which is literally the seed of life of God. But I don't want to get stuck there on that, but look at verse 2. It says, beloved, now we are, what? Children of God. Now? How can that be? Now we are children of God, and it has not yet been revealed what we shall be. Not by any wild stretch of the imagination can you possibly comprehend what we shall be if we make it into the God family. It is not yet revealed what we shall be, but we know that when he is revealed, read that next phrase, we shall be like him. You will? I believe that God inspired John to write that, the Apostle John to write that. We shall be like him, to step out and say, let there be light, and there's light. You think God's going to give you that power if you don't know how to use it? We have a purpose in this life to learn how to use that awesomeness of God. We better do it. Because we're not going to get that power unless we do. There's no question in my mind about that. God tells us how to go at many of these things, and that's not in this sermon. This sermon is, I'm trying to tell you the awesomeness of that power that God has. That's what I want to get across to you. You see that we know that when he is revealed, we shall be like him. We'll see him as he is. And everyone who has this hope in him, and I hope you have that hope in you, purifies himself just as he is pure. Now that's a pretty big undertaking. And I'm a long ways off. I'm pretty dirty, I'll guarantee you. I'm not that pure. But I want to be. And I have set my will to do that with his power because he has to do it. I can't. I can't furnish that power. Only God can. He was the one that divested himself of divinity in order to give me that opportunity and to give you that opportunity. And once we're changed from mortal to immortal, then we can have that power because we will have proved irrefutably to God that our desire will not be to ever misuse it. And if we get the strength to be able to carry that out, then we'll be trustworthy in the family of God. I wanted to present that because I wanted you to get that picture. Does this really say that you could have that power? It does to me. But it's conditioned upon the fact that you can be trustworthy with it. And you know that and I know that. We have to prove to God irrefutably, no refuting of the fact that we'll ever, ever, ever turn away from obedience to God. But with that power, who would ever want to? There'd never be any reason. No pain, no sorrow, no suffering of any kind. And we've got to prove that we mean it when we say we want to be like God. The Apostle Paul had to learn that lesson also. Now, I'm sure thankful for him, because how he did some of that is almost beyond my imagination. But I want to turn to 2 Corinthians, the 12th chapter, and I'll quit with this. 2 Corinthians, the 12th chapter, and talk about what the Apostle Paul said. I'll start in verse 7. 2 Corinthians, the 12th chapter, and verse 7. The Apostle Paul wrote all of these various things, and how he got all of these things that he wrote here out of all of the Old Testament is beyond me, but he did. Well, out of the Old Testament and his instruction for 3 years under Christ out in the desert. He got a flash course there. But he says in verse 7, 2 Corinthians 12, "Lest I should be exalted above measure by the abundance of the revelations." Oh, I could get the big head. Because God has revealed all of these things to me, he says. "Lest I should do that, a thorn in the flesh was given to me, a messenger of Satan to buffet me, lest I be exalted above measure." He wasn't about to get the big head. God was going to see to that. Now, concerning this thing, verse 8, concerning that very fact, I pleaded with the Lord three times. I don't think that he just got on his knees and prayed three times about that affliction, that God would take that away from him. I think he is actually formally anointed three different times for it. And if I'm wrong, I'll stand corrected when the time comes. But I think that's what it means when it says, hey, three times that he pleaded with the Lord, three times that it might depart from him. He got his answer. And what was it? Verse 9, he said to me, "My grace is sufficient for you, for my strength is made perfect in weakness." Can that relate to any of your problems and your hurts and your pains and your miseries? Does it make sense that we have to have certain reminders that have to keep us in line, and that we need God, lest we kind of get exalted and say, "Well, I know it now." No, we can't get exalted above measure, as the Apostle Paul says. But what did he finish off with here in verse 9? He said, "Therefore," because he got that answer, "Therefore, most gladly, I will rather boast in my infirmities that the power of Christ," that power I'm talking about, "that the power of Christ may rest upon me. Therefore, I take pleasure in infirmities." Now, it doesn't like to hurt any more than you and I do. But because of the awesomeness of what God offers him, in order for him to reach the place where he could receive that power, he was willing to take all of the infirmities that God put on him, because he did. He was the one that also wrote, "He'll not suffer you more than you're able to bear." Therefore, I take pleasure in infirmities, in reproaches, in needs, in persecutions, in distresses, for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, then I'm strong. Now, I'm pretty weak, I'll assure you. If there was any way to compare to God, well, I couldn't even make a tidbit in weakness of that absolutely unthinkable power of God. But God says that you can be like him and see him as he is. Is that incentive enough for you to want to go ahead and put up with all of the difficulties that you have and the pains that you have to bear? Is that enough of a reward for you and me if He offers all of that? I think it's absolutely fantastic that we can have that privilege.